This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Our expanding tastes for all things food-related have breathed new life into old industries and given birth to new twists on some of those older industries. Coffee has experienced an explosion of interest in well-made brews and exotic beans and flavors. Interest in craft beer has resulted in an explosion of local breweries popping up on almost every block. And now, distillers have come out of the shadows, experiencing a demand not unlike that for craft beer. People want to experience what local distillers have come up with. But beer brewers and distillers face some similar problems, despite the fact that local distillers have moved from the backwoods and illegal hooch to legally produce high-quality adult beverages. They, like brewers, face some laws that hold them back. Just as we did with craft brewers a while ago, we explore those restrictions along with some rules that have been loosened a bit as we examine this phenomenon. Andrew Porter is owner of Doc Porter's Distillery, located in Charlotte near Old Mecklenburg Brewery. They've been distilling vodka from North Carolina wheat. Gin and bourbon are on the way, I am told. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Rob Delaney, owns Muddy River Distillery in Belmont. They're building a reputation for rum. In fact, Muddy River is the first rum distillery in North Carolina, producing four varieties, all made from their custom-built stills. Thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks for having me.
Why custom-built? I'm just curious.
Keep the investors away.
Stay
out of debt.
This is like moonshine, then, is the approach. Both Andrew and Rob are in our Spirit Square studio, and joining us by phone is Scott Maitland, who is the owner of Top of the Hill Restaurant and Topo Organic Spirits in Chapel Hill. Topo calls itself the state's first and only organic distillery, producing grain-to-glass vodka, whiskey, and gin. He is also president of the North Carolina Distillers Association. He joins us by phone. Good morning. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So when did local distilleries start popping up around Charlotte? Who was first? Which one of you? One of you was first.
Robbie was first.
Okay. And we were in Belmont, just outside of Charlotte.
We call that Charlotte.
Yeah,
I do too. Well, we made Queen Charlotte's Reserve, so we're really proud of being here. In fact, I live in Charlotte. We started in 2011.
Were you the first? In the region, or were there others?
It depends how you want to figure it. We're the first rum.
I'll give it to him.
So what is driving this, not only here but in other places around the state like Chapel Hill? What's driving this? Is it simply entrepreneurs, connoisseurs of fine liquors who want to make their own and share it with other people? Or is there a demand for this from consumers?
Well, I can tell you it's not regulation that's driving it.
No, it's not. We'll talk about that.
I think it's just seeing the success of the craft beer industry.
Really?
And knowing the potential that we have with everybody wanting to know how their products are made, wanting to explore, you know, the facilities that we create and just know where their products come from.
Scott.
Yeah, I mean, what was driving it for me, I was actually going to build a second brewery. And realized in the process of that if I did a distillery instead, I could use all local ingredients. And obviously, I've been a brewery for 20 years and proud of what craft beer has done. But the one Achilles heel on that is that breweries don't use North Carolina agricultural ingredients to make North Carolina beer. And distilleries do. And so we can make world-class spirits using only North Carolina ingredients. And that was exciting to me from a local economy issue, from a sustainable perspective, and obviously the organic perspective as well.
You use North Carolina wheat, as I said in the beginning of this, Andrew.
Yeah, that's correct.
How much does that contribute to the farmer's livelihood or to the local economy? How important is that to you personally? How important is that to the people who buy your product?
Yeah, that's very important to us. Working with local farmers is a huge part of our business. Our local farmer grows not only wheat, but our corn for our bourbon. We also get our malted barley from Asheville, from Riverbend Malt House. And actually, we recycle our spent mash, and we give that back to a different local farmer who feeds it to his pigs and cattle. So we really try and contribute and make sure everything stays in the state.
So this is all a part of what we've been talking about on this program for years now, and that is this local food movement, people trying to support the local economy, support local farmers, keep things local, keep things in many cases organic. And just make it's like a circle of life here that's shrinking from the international national food scope to something smaller but more sustainable.
Right.
Well, what? I got to tell you, too, I think it's larger than that. I don't think people realize how big of a business agriculture is, and that we don't think of liquor as being an agricultural product, but it is, or it can be. What we're doing, you know, what Robbie's doing, what Andrew's doing, what I'm doing, liquor is an actual agricultural product. And being able to keep all of that agricultural money circulating within our state, the power of that is pretty incredible. And the sheer financial impact is extremely large, especially as we all start to export as well.
We've done several shows on craft beer here. We've done a show on bourbon, using some bourbon connoisseurs. And I'm just curious, because there's so many choices when you go to the ABC store or you go to Frugal McDougal's.
Right.
There's so many choices of different brands of gin and vodka and you name it. What do you guys bring to the table that I can't get from the national and internationally made products, aside from the local aspect of where you get your ingredients?
Oh, it's better.
Yeah.
Why?
It's better because on a small scale, we put a more hands-on approach. We're more selective in our cuts. We use better ingredients. We don't automate our equipment. So everything we do is very carefully selected.
Is it consistent, or can you be consistent with like
consistent. For me, I rely on my wife. She's our taster. She's the one that knows the difference, the subtle differences in the product.
Does she rinse and spit, or does she?
Oh no, she takes it. She takes it like a professional.
Scott, I know you wanted to chime in on that.
Well, you know, it's funny because. The joke in the beer world is beer guys swallow and, you know, wine guys spit.
Right.
So we all told ourselves we were going to have to learn how to spit when doing the distillery, but it just hasn't happened.
So now, well, you're all sober this morning, so that's a good sign, I guess.
Well, going back to what the difference is, one of the dirty secrets in the larger liquor industry is that 70% of distilleries do not make their alcohol from scratch. They buy the alcohol already made by a mass alcohol producer, and then maybe redistill, maybe not, maybe just bottle that alcohol. So what's the difference? Well, the difference is that when you are making bulk alcohol, you're not sure whether that alcohol is going to end up in a drink, in a gas tank, or in a cosmetic. Mm. So when you're the commercial fermenter making that bulk alcohol, you end up choosing out of the thousands of yeast that you could use to ferment, the yeast that leans towards the most production of ethanol. And the problem with that is that typically you aren't making then decisions about taste, and as a result, that base fermentation, that beer or that wine that is made to begin with, that fermentation isn't done with taste in mind. And as a result, when ultimately it gets to distilling, that poor fermentation practice leaks through. And so folks like us that are doing it from grain to glass, we control every step along the way, and most people don't realize that, you know, fermentation is 60 to 65% of the trick.
Yeah, we learned that in our bourbon show, that there are these massive distillers of alcohol or bourbons that people just buy and put in and maybe alter the formula slightly or whatever. They just buy it in en masse, and you don't know where it came from, you don't know what it was made from, et cetera. But it's happening in all kinds of brands all over the country. That's important in bourbon because you really want to taste it. You want to taste the flavor of whatever it is you're distilling.
Well, and it's a little more insidious when you talk about vodkas and gin.
That's what's going to get
because
it.
At least in bourbon, there is regulations about what that bourbon needs to be made from.
Right.
And the bourbon, the bulk bourbon folks are at least following certain procedural requirements. But when it comes to vodkas and gins, what people are doing is buying neutral grain spirits, and in that sense, it's a wide open world, and what you find is a very industrial type alcohol being used as the basis for vodka and gin, as opposed to what we all are doing in terms of actually fermenting it from scratch. Because when you talk to a distiller, distillers want to talk about distilling, but the reality is that separating that alcohol through distillation begs the question, how well was the alcohol made to begin with?
You're brewing, you're distilling vodka at the moment. Mm-hmm. Can you taste the difference?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, And just as Scott was saying, it all comes down to fermentation. That's where you're actually creating the flavor. The distillation part, that's almost – it's difficult, but it's almost like the easy part. And when it's done in the industrial level, as he was saying, that's when they're going for the most efficient yeast, the most neutral flavor, and that's when you can't really taste them, any of the base grains come through. And that's why we decided to use 100% North Carolina wheat, so you can actually taste the base grains and you can actually taste a little bit of that wheat carrying through.
Most of the craft brewers that I've met are people who started out as connoisseurs of beer, who love beer, who maybe started at home with a small batch and decided, I need to expand this out. Is the same true of these distillers that are popping up around the state? Did they come to this because either they were doing this either legally or illegally in small batches at the house, or because they found that they really liked small, specially brewed or distilled brands, why not do it myself?
Well, as the president of the Distillers Association, nobody has ever done this illegally at home, by the way.
Amen. Amen.
Right. Absolutely not.
Okay.
Take it from there.
But are most brewers, are most distillers connoisseurs?
I think in North Carolina, most people had their heart in it long before they became professionals. And that's how you get through it, just like any business. The best ones, the most successful ones, start from people that run their business based on the passion they have for it, not based on profits.
And as I understand it, it is not inexpensive to get into this business. It costs a lot of money in equipment, et cetera, and license. And we'll talk about the hoops that you had to jump through to open the front doors in the first place in a few minutes here. But you guys seem to be pioneers. You're on the people pushing west on this. How risky did you regard this as an investment? How much did you stake your life on this to open the doors?
A lot. I mean, we have a lot of money into this and a lot of time, a lot of effort, and we're hoping that the legislation can change, and it's starting to change, but it's really a little bit restricted for us at the moment. Yeah. And just moving forward, we know that the people of North Carolina love craft spirits and that they'll want to get their hands on it more.
You have a successful restaurant, Scott, in Chapel Hill, Top of the Hill, and now you have a Tapo Organic Distillery, which I believe got its start in 2008. Did that grow out of the restaurant business, or was this just something you decided, if I make this, I can serve it in the restaurant?
Yeah, so Top of the Hill is actually a brew pub, so okay. We have been a craft brewery since 1996. And actually, we were the second brewery in the country to put microbrewed beer in a can. Hmm. Now, I did that so people would have a better package to take home from the restaurant, but immediately realized that I could distribute that. This is back in 2004, and I needed to build a second brewery because we ran out of capacity. But it was in the process of building that brewery that I realized that if we did a distillery instead, we could use all local ingredients. And I should have been open in 2008, but I got held up by state and local regulations, and so we didn't get open until 2012.
And can you sell what you distill in your restaurant?
Well, I can, but I have to sell it to the state first. So, we make it, we sell it to the state, and then the restaurant buys it back from the state.
And that is not the case with the beer that you brew, is that correct?
That's right. Although, there's a little more of a fine point. The distillery is actually three blocks down the street.
Right.
And they're two different companies and all that, whereas the brewery is,
right there,
part of the restaurant operation. But I do think that, perhaps one day the natural evolution of this is, why can't we have a micro-distilled restaurant as well?
Scott Maitland is the owner of Tapo Organic Spirits. We'll talk about the organic nature of what he does up there in Chapel Hill. He's also the president of the North Carolina Distillers Association. Rob Delaney is here from Muddy River Distillery in Belmont, and Andrew Porter from Doc Porter's Distillery here in Charlotte. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members at High Point University, a liberal arts-based institution providing students a college experience grounded in holistic education, experiential learning, and values-based living. Details at highpoint.edu. And Discovery Place, presenting Body Worlds and the Cycle of Life, the new exhibition with over 100 real human specimens displaying the differences in the human body due to distress, disease, and optimal health. Tickets at discoveryplace.org. On this week's Regional Weekly News Roundup, Saturday, South Carolina Democratic primary. Does Hillary have it in the bag? The Charlotte City Council approves a non-discrimination ordinance, but the governor and the legislature have problems with it. We take another look at the ongoing debate at CMS over pupil assignment and much, much more. You can catch up on the weekly regional news, then the national and international news at 10 and 11, all tomorrow beginning at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Senate Republican leaders say they won't hold hearings for a Supreme Court justice nominee. This makes an Obama appointment before the end of his presidency highly unlikely. What an 8-member Supreme Court could mean for key cases to be decided this year.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Andrew Porter, owner of Doc Porter's Distillery in Charlotte, Rob Delaney, owner of Muddy River Distillery in Belmont, Scott Maitland, owner of Tapa Organic Spirits in Chapel Hill, and the president of the North Carolina Distillers Association. Sounds like I've been drinking. You make a point of pushing, Scott, the organic nature of your spirits, and in fact are quick to brag that you are the only fully local and USDA-certified organic distillery in the Deep South. How important is the organic nature of a distilled product to consumers, or to the flavor of it, or to whatever?
Well, it's more important than even I realized. I actually got on the organic side because I became very concerned about pollinators, and not to go far afield, but bottom line is that with the rise of GMO crops 15 years ago, we've seen a corresponding problem with bees and butterflies having some issues. And nobody really understands the connection, but one thing we do understand is that organic practices allow a better habitat for pollinators because, for example, with butterflies, the number one habitat of monarch butterflies, with which we've lost 90% of their population in the past 15 years, the number one habitat is milkweed, and that's one of the weeds that we're trying to kill with the herbicides that we apply. So organic farming allows habitat for pollinators, and, one out of every two bites of food that we eat come from pollinators, so they're kind of important. And yeah. So that's kind of how we got into it. What I was surprised to really realize, though, is I actually think that organic wheat's got a flavor that, non-organic wheat doesn't have. So we think there is a flavor issue as well.
Rob, yours is, I believe, the next oldest distillery around our table. You may be the oldest around the table now that I've heard that he opened up in 2012 and not 2008. Muddy River Distillery opened in 2011, in fact. Is that right?
No, well, that's back to establishment.
Okay.
And we were actually legal in 2012.
Okay, so establishment means what?
That means filed the paperwork for the company.
And we're going to talk about that's all part of the hoops you have to jump through. But anyway, at the time, you are the fifth distiller in the state and the first craft rum distiller since Prohibition. Why did you start and why your focus on rum?
Well, we started, I think like a lot of people, the economy was doing what it was back then. And I was in the construction industry. So traveling throughout the Southeast to keep a construction job kind of pushed me in the direction of craft distilling. And it all started literally with an in-flight magazine. I started with an in-flight magazine to get the idea, and then, skipping a couple of those steps, we start making rum, we start a business, and
what was it about being in construction that prepared you to be a distiller?
Well, I think a lot of it came to building. We built our equipment, and I think that's very important. Recycled dairy tanks from local farmers, using pieces here and there, building our stills so that we knew, that's pretty much what taught us how to make liquor, was by piecing these things together, and they're reflux columns. Each one's 5 plates. I think that had a lot to do with it, with my background of putting all that together.
And you have a partner who I helped. I believe you helped develop what you call a special recipe for your rum. And I know, like Coca-Cola guards their recipe like Fort Knox. I mean, you're not going to share the recipe with us, but what does that special recipe do for what you produce, the rum that you produce?
Well, back to fermentation, to be considered rum, it has to be sugarcane-based. So we use American molasses and white granulated sugar. That, with water and yeast, makes our, what I call, molasses wine. Not much to it. Mm-hmm. The ratios of those things and the type of yeast we use are proprietary. What really makes it special from there is after fermentation, the distillation is done primarily by my wife. She's our secret weapon, so to speak, and she's the one that makes our product what it is.
And where did she learn how to do that?
Drinking on the job is how she learned how to do it.
She's sitting here. She's going to kill you after this is over. Andrew, you are the newest distiller here, the Doc Porter's Distillery. I think just opened in November, if I'm not mistaken, down the street from Old Mecklenburg Brewery. And you say that you are lucky because you started at the peak season for craft spirits. They have a peak season?
That's right. Yeah, it's the holiday season around Thanksgiving and Christmas. People do their drinking.
And with the new law.
Oh, yeah, and with the new law, because the new law that came on board allows us to sell one bottle per person per year from the distillery started in October, so we were lucky to open up right in November, take advantage of that.
And you had home-brewed beer while growing up, and you continued that through college, and you have a chemical engineering background
as well.
So did that interest in brewing and what you know about chemical engineering play a role in wanting to become a distiller of spirits?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I'm still a chemical engineer. I still do that.
Does that help you in what you do as a distiller?
Yeah, and actually being a distiller helps me at chemical engineering as well. There's some things I learned by actually doing it by hand that I can apply to my job. But growing up, I actually, before I went to college, I was kind of trying to decide between a culinary degree and an engineering degree, so I was happy to be able to kind of put those two together and end up with distilling.
And both you and Scott have craft beer experience under your belt before you got into the distillery business, but you say that distilling is more difficult, more challenging, and more science involved than in craft beer manufacturing. How so?
Well, it's just the extra step of the distillation is kind of the scientific the more scientific part of it. I mean, brewing beer is definitely hard, and there's a lot of science involved, a lot of biology, trying to keep your yeast happy, making them create the best flavors. But it's actually the distillation and dealing with the steam boiler to heat your distillation, and a lot of heat transfer of cooling, and just trying to balance all that stuff out to make it a consistent product is the kind of scientific aspect.
And I know, Scott, you believe that the craft beer movement has created what you call a wealth of knowledge about fermentation that's now being used by distilleries. And that actually surprised me when I read that, because it seems to me that man has been brewing beer and making distilled spirits since the beginning of time. What could we possibly learn about fermentation that we don't already know?
Well, I think the reality is how many people in the state of North Carolina now understand the science behind fermentation. And it is kind of, if you start fermenting, especially commercially, gentlemen, feel free to contradict me, but at some point you do start thinking about distillation because it's just the next step of what you're doing. Mm-hmm. But I think what we've done as a state over the last 20 years with the craft beer movement is that we have created an infrastructure to support that craft beer movement, both on the commercial side, and now we're seeing it on the educational side where we've got actual degree programs in fermentation science going on. And that educational, infrastructure, both on the private and the public side, is feeding the talent that we need to be able to, and this is, hold your socks on this, but there are now going to be 52 distillers in North Carolina by the end of this year, mm-hmm. right? So this requires a lot of people with a lot of knowledge. So it's not necessarily that fermentation science is necessarily advanced, although I would argue it has, but it's more that in the 70s there was only 52 breweries in the United States, and now we're up to, back to 5,000, 140 in North Carolina, and so we've got a reservoir of talent and people that are spinning off this industry that can support this closely related industry of distilling, which has the added advantage of the history of itself of North Carolina.
If Prohibition had never occurred, where would we be today with distilleries and craft beer brewers? Would they be on every corner by now? Seriously.
I think, yeah, they would.
Because we're still recovering from Prohibition, particularly in areas like the South.
Right.
Yeah, especially in the South.
A lot of moonshine was made in North Carolina during the era of Prohibition. It led, as I said in the beginning, to the founding of NASCAR, because moonshiners souped up their cars to outrun the revenuers who were trying to catch them, find them, put them in jail. How has that played a role in the talent pool of who you have to lean on? Because I'm sure that moonshine is still being made, but you guys have been able to come out of the shadows with your legal product. But do you know, do you rely on, do you talk to people who have made this stuff for years up in the mountains? And have they come down the mountain to help you with your products anywhere in the state?
You see a lot of distilleries popping up in the state that make moonshine. I think the ones that you have here today, we don't necessarily have that background, but I'm not selecting from that pool, but a lot of people do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And actually, I will reverse it. I think that what's fascinating is that because moonshining was kept in the shadows, what's interesting is when people do come out of the woods to talk to an actual distiller, licensed distiller, you know, what the licensed distiller finds is sometimes very amusing ways, like, you know, people using, you know, bread yeast. Well, that's not an optimum solution, but that's the yeast the moonshiner can get his hands on, you know what I mean? And so there is some recipes and things that are handed down from generation to generation that aren't necessarily optimum from the distilling perspective, but it does reflect the materials that were available to that moonshiner. So it is it is a fascinating history, and it's fun to be a part of it. I do think from a perception basis, you know, Topo's now in 14 states. When we go into other states, I think that there is this perception that, you know, well, man, you guys are from the Carolinas. Man, you know how to make your stuff down there. I think that we should take advantage of that.
Yeah. Prohibition not only shut down alcohol production across this country to a great degree, although I guess we could export it during Prohibition. We just couldn't sell it domestically. The repeal of Prohibition also added a lot of safeguards, what were, I guess, regarded as safeguards to the books in various states, including North Carolina. I know that craft beer brewers worry that what they see as antiquated distribution laws in this state are holding them back and even threaten, in some cases, their survival. And you say, Scott, that you underestimated the legal and regulatory differences between beer and liquor and even misjudged regulatory support for micro-distilling in the state. What does that mean, that there are significant roadblocks, intentional or unintentional, to your existence and your expansion?
Yeah, so, you know, I when I got into it, I thought, well, this is not going to be difficult. I have had a brewery for a long time. I understand the lay of the land, and I understand the regulators involved. But the reality is, I don't think anyone has set up roadblocks per se. But going back to your earlier question about the history of distilling, what's fascinating is that, you know, on the brewing side, there used to be a plethora of breweries, literally 5,000 breweries. It shrunk to 50, and now it's back up to 5,000. That was not the case on distilling. Basically, distilling has always been dominated by 6 or 7 major distilleries. And as a result, the regulatory framework that surrounds all of that reflects this large distilling thing. And believe it or not, that all goes back to Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson, and it's pretty fascinating. My point, though, is that we set up a liquor distribution system through the ABC system that never really contemplated the idea that there would be, you know, distilleries in our state. And we are working through issues that negatively impact the ability of someone to start a distillery in North Carolina because it's difficult sometimes to get access to markets. But you know, we have had some success on a legislative front, and I think we've also had just some success in terms of developing relationships with our partners in the ABC system. And people are starting to realize, hey, this is a phenomenon that's not going away. And, you know, of the almost $1 billion of spirits that are sold in North Carolina now, you know, why can't we have more than, you know, 0.3% actually be manufactured in North Carolina? It would behoove the state to develop this industry.
You sound a lot calmer in your approach toward regulation than the craft brewers that we had on this program about a month and a half ago talking about some of the obstacles that they see because of rules and regulations. Andrew, you say that at the top of the regulatory chain is the federal government, and opening your all of you guys faced problems opening your distilleries. So what challenges does the federal government pose?
Well, the federal government, it's kind of just they're kind of overwhelmed right now because, as Scott said, they were set up for a lot of small, not a very large number of distilleries, and now there's over 1,000 distilleries in the country. So there's this influx of all these small distilleries. So just to apply for your federal basic permit, it takes about 150 days. So, and before you can even apply for that, you need to have a lease on a space and you need to have your equipment.
Yeah, this is really interesting to me. Before you can apply to be a business, you have to have a place for the business. You have to have the lease signed. Mm-hmm. You have to have already purchased your equipment. Mm-hmm. Suppose they turn you down.
It's yeah, not an option.
That's what my bank, honestly, I went through a whole banking, you know, loan procedure, went through four bankers, and it was ultimately the last of five bankers that said, wait a minute, what if you get turned down? And that,
yeah.
That you turned out into a four-month delay.
You have to provide schematics and serial numbers for your equipment to the federal government, and you have to have a lease for a year before the government will approve your permit, all before you get the state permit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is rigorous.
And it's illegal to possess a functioning still in the state of North Carolina.
So the schematics are in theory?
No. You have to possess the equipment. You have to be within 90% of functionality before you can apply.
You're telling me that you're breaking the law even as you sit here.
Yes, and the state will tell you that jokingly, that you've been breaking the law up to the point where they hand you the permit.
And you designed your own equipment. You designed your own still. So you had to come up with your own schematics?
Oh, yeah. They want everything.
And if you design your own still, you don't have serial numbers.
It's important. With distillation, the equipment you use is very important. You can only use certain materials and things like that. It can be dangerous, and that's why you have to have the equipment so the federal government can say, hey, this is legitimate.
So are they looking at it for safety reasons, for distillery safety reasons, or consumption safety reasons?
Consumption safety.
Okay. So, but you have to have serial numbers. If you build your own still, you don't have
serial numbers. It's all about taxes in that case. They need to be able to come in and audit you and know your production basis. They know everything about you and your procedures. So it's very elaborate.
Do beer brewers, craft beer brewers, have to jump through any of the hoops we just talked about? Or can they just buy some
Scott
equipment
would
and
probably
open
speak to that better than anybody. But
we would.
But yeah, we have the brewery or winery in the back, and then we distill it in the front. So it's, you know, I don't know. Scott, what do you think about that?
Well, I actually do my business in the front and party in the back. But no. brewers have to go through a similar thing, but it's not nearly as rigorous. And part of that is simply because, you know, unfortunately, the folks you're talking to today, Mike, are the folks that have helped kind of, you know, create the process. And so now you've got regulatory folks that are on a state level, you know, and on a local federal level, understanding and familiar with what's going on. So we you know, in many ways we've created a new paradigm and people are in it.
But since you brew craft beer, did you have to go through any of these? Did you have to have your equipment purchased, your lease signed, et cetera, before you opened the doors and started brewing your first batch of beer? Or are these just for distilleries, these rules?
No. So any alcohol producer, at least back in when I was getting my license back in 94, 95, I had to do all of that. On the distilling side, though, there is another whole level of concern, basically because it is so much easier to bootleg liquor because of the reduced volume and value of it that the tax folks are very, very interested in it.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot harder to bootleg beer than it is to bootleg 160 proof.
We're going to come back and talk about some of the obstacles of selling the product once you've got the place up and running and jump through all of those hoops with our three distillers here, Scott Maitland from Chapel Hill, Rob Delaney from Belmont, and Andrew Porter from Charlotte. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Charlotte Ballet's Little Mermaid, featuring the underwater world created by Hans Christian Andersen and brought to life by new sets and costumes, March 11th through 20th at Knight Theater. Tickets and information at charlotteballet.org. Senate Republican leaders say they will not hold hearings for a Supreme Court justice nominee, and this makes President Obama's appointment before the end of his presidency highly unlikely. But what does an 8-member evenly divided Supreme Court mean for key cases to be decided next year? That's the topic of the conversation. Coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. If you'd like to join our conversation, email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
All Things Considered has been there through controversial wars.
Thousands of young people came to Washington.
National disasters.
Challenger, go with throttle up.
The explosion in the clear blue
and breakthrough moments.
Just let it sink in. An African-American president of the United States of America.
4 decades of bringing you the news on All Things Considered every afternoon.
All Things Considered weekday afternoons beginning at 4 on WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the distillation of spirits in North Carolina, specifically vodka from Doc Porter's distillery. Andrew Porter is here. He's the owner, and soon, I believe, bourbon and gin are on the way. How close are you to producing your first batch of bourbon and or gin?
We've been producing our bourbon since last December.
Is it good?
It's delicious, but it still needs some time in the barrel. So it takes time for it to mature in the barrel. We use slightly smaller barrels. So a typical large producer bourbon uses 53-gallon barrels. We use 15 and 25-gallon barrels. So whereas their bourbon is typically 3 to 4 years to mature, ours is closer to 1.5 to 2 years.
Wow.
So we're definitely waiting patiently.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest challenges with liquor that people don't understand is the return on investment is insane. I mean, it's for our 6 products, the quickest turnaround is 5 months. And then from there up to 15, 20 years before you get paid on the investment.
Yeah, and as I understand it nationally, like bourbon, Maker's Mark got a little shorthanded with there was a greater demand for bourbon than they thought. And they're 5 or 6 or 7 years out, so they just can't turn on a dime, which is why they wanted to water it down.
Right, you have to anticipate that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's Rob Delaney, who's the owner of Muddy River Distillery in Belmont. He makes rum at the moment. And Scott Maitland is joining us by phone from Chapel Hill. Topo Organic Spirits is the name of his distillery, and he's making all kinds of things up there. Let me see what you got here on my list. Vodka, whiskey, and gin, I think, at the moment, up there. So let me share with you some comments that have come in as we've been talking here on the radio. We asked on social media, have you been to any of the local distilleries and what makes them so popular? I'm not sure we're getting an answer to that question, but we're getting other questions. A listener, the home distilling movement is facing the same obstacles that home brewers faced and still face: antiquated laws, obstruction by distributors and manufacturers. I heartily agree about the mass producers. When I made stuff with the highest alcohol producing yeasts, it was harsh. Even after filtering, I find that my choice of yeasts vastly changes the end product. That is why I'm involved, same as when I make beer. Personal control. Tony and Hickory, I heard something years ago that no distillery in the USA has ever gone bankrupt. If that's true, I wish the business professors in college a long time ago had told us. Is that true? They've never gone bankrupt?
Well, don't ever ask a business professor to tell you the success or failure of what he's trying to teach you, because he's taking your money.
Yeah. I'm a business professor.
Aside from Prohibition, have distillers ever gone bankrupt?
I'm sure they have. I've seen them go out of business. So
I know for a fact, both historically and in modern times, people have gone out of business. Yeah. There's not even a question.
Dave in Monroe, do these guys make vodka from potatoes or grain? You make it from wheat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Scott, what do you make it from?
I make it from soft red winnow wheat.
Why wheat and not potatoes? I always thought vodka was made from potatoes. I guess that's the Russian in it.
Yeah, we're the American version.
Yep. Yeah, so traditionally vodka was made from potatoes, and that's because a lot of vodka came from Poland.
Right.
And that's what they grow. It's usually whatever grows best regionally. So typically in the United States we grow a lot of corn, so that's the base grain for most vodkas made in the U.S.
Really?
But North Carolina, we grow a lot of both wheat and corn, and we chose to go with wheat because we think it gives it a more delicate taste.
Ben writes, as a migrant from Georgia and a Scotch lover, I have been shocked by the lack of diversity in distillers available through state-run ABC stores. I love the idea of stocking my home bar with locally manufactured spirits. This is joy in your ears, right?
Oh, yeah.
Hearing that?
Totally.
Three questions. Can your products be bought at your manufacturer sites? Are there any Charlotte ABC venues that carry more local labels or any nearby in South Carolina? And how do you intend to advocate for easier breakthrough into the steady, already strong national and international markets so that we can see you on shelves? Let's start with one of the obstacles, which he talked about, and that is on-site sales. In October of 2015, a new law went into effect in North Carolina allowing you to sell your product at your distillery. But only one bottle per person per year.
After taking a tour.
What's up with that?
It's baby steps to changing regulation in the state. And we're most of us, the volume of our products go through ABC. So you can find all of our stuff in, you know, the 623 ABC stores in your state. If you don't see it on the shelf already, you can simply ask for it. And there, most ABC stores will pick it up for you. So we are available through there. It's really cool to come out to the distillery. For the past 4 months, we've been able to sell out of there.
But one bottle per person per year, and you have to take a tour, and you have to give them your driver's license. You have to give you your driver's license.
It's tedious, but that's because of that October 1st thing law. We hired our first employees. So
but why one? Are they worried about taking sales away from the state-owned and operated ABC
stores? The initial
stores?
Fear was they were scared it was going to go private. We were going to be the crack in the dam. And they're seeing now that that's just not the case.
But you see this as a game changer.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's evidence. They're seeing not only our sales increase out of the distillery, but because of this law changing, our sales are also increasing in the surrounding ABC stores. So we're not taking their business away. We're actually growing it.
And I got to tell you, though, there's another dynamic to this, too, because all of what they just said was true. And, you know, even the executive director of the ABC said, yeah, we're seeing a rise in the sale of North Carolina spirits in ABC stores. And the good news about Charlotte is Jason, who is the CEO of Mecklenburg ABC, has really revamped the 2016 marketing plan for Mecklenburg ABC and will be featuring local distilleries much more prominently than they have in the past. We appreciate the support from Mecklenburg. But here's the big thing. Going back to why craft brewers are incensed, you need to understand that it's not just when we talk about these laws, it's not just about the ABC Commission or the ABC boards. There are other players involved. And the real driver on the one bottle per person per year discussion was really, you know, the wine and beer distributors. And they wanted to make sure that craft spirits didn't get an advantage or share and be able to have the same advantages that craft beer and wine did.
Yeah, they're the beer brewers are complaining about the distribution laws because they really favor the big distributors, and if you get in with a big distributor, according to the craft beer brewers, you can't get out of that relationship.
That's right.
It's almost impossible.
The beer distributors in general have basically dominated alcohol policy in the state of North Carolina, and they truly like things as they are.
Yeah.
And so they work very hard to make sure there's no change at all. So one of the misunderstandings, even within our own Distillers Association, is that the ABC was the big reason for the one bottle per year. And I will tell you that actually there were other players that forced that one bottle per person per year rule, not the ABC board.
Well, you're sitting up there in Wake County, Scott, and you're talking favorably about Mecklenburg County's ABC board, but that brings up another issue, and that is the fact that there are 99 ABC boards, aren't there 100 or something like that around the state? And you have to
160.
Yeah, 167.
So you have to go through each and every one of them individually to beg for shelf space.
Well, you ask
on the stores.
Yes, like any business, you have to sell your product, and so I don't see that as necessary. It is crazy. You know,
but if you were in New Jersey and Harris Teeter were operating in New Jersey, you could just go to Harris Teeter and say, put me on your shelves, because they can sell liquor in grocery stores
right.
in New Jersey.
Right.
But here, you'd have to go to 100 and some ABC
things. And a lot of people that approach us, at least, assume that once you're in North Carolina ABC, you're in 623 stores. That is not the case.
No.
You need to sell your product.
Is there reluctance to put locally produced small batch brewers on distillers on the shelves because they have so much other product that they know will sell because it's got a big name?
Yeah. I mean, they just want to be convinced that our product will sell. And they pretty much are saying, what are you doing to market yourself
in our area? Doesn't that call into question the whole apparatus of how we sell alcohol in North Carolina? I mean, they're worried about what, making a profit or not lose? What are they worried about? Because this is a state. This is a state that says that alcohol is bad. We control it. But they want to make a profit on it.
Yeah, shelf space is real estate, and real estate's very valuable. So you have to convince them that your product's going to sell better than somebody else, not just because it's local. They're not concerned about.
Let's flip the coin over. Do they have a point? Are you going to sell as well as some of the name brand bottles?
We can. We just need to be on the shelf first. So a lot of time it's convincing them on the shelf.
But as a local person walking into the ABC store, and I know I'm having a party, and so I got to have one of each. I got to have a bottle of vodka. I got to have a bottle of gin. I got to have a bottle of bourbon. Is it just not easier for me to go and go, I'll just take what I always get? So yeah. I'm going to ignore you because I've never heard of you, and that label is looks odd to me. I don't know that you're organic or that you're local. I just want to buy what I'm going to buy, and let me get the heck out of there.
Yeah, we can dominate sales-wise when we are put on the shelf. And going back to what Scott was saying earlier, the power of our dollar is much stronger than, say, buying a bottle of Jack Daniels because our dollar is going back into our local economy.
Yes, but does the buyer just walking into the store
Mike,
know
that's
that?
That's the importance of the one bottle per person per year. So, you know, the reality is one of the misunderstandings of our desire to have that ability was not to become a liquor store at the distillery. We're too busy actually making booze to run a liquor store, and no sane person would come to the distillery repeatedly just to buy a bottle when you can go to an ABC store and have a plethora of options. And so the reality is we're going to build this business just like we did in craft beer. We're going to have people come, get familiar with the brand, and more importantly, just familiar with the process. So, you know, the big problem that craft distilling has over craft beer was back in the beginning when I would say, hey, here's, you know, people would walk in the top of the hill and say, I'd like a Bud Light. And I say, I'm sorry, I'm a brewery. I only serve what I make. Good, bad, or otherwise, at least they could visually see a difference in the beer. Mm-hmm. The problem with craft distilling is there visually is no difference between the spirits. And so the opportunity to get people into the distillery, to give them a tour, make sure the consumers understand that there is, in fact, a difference in our products, even if you can't see it. There is no shortcut. We got to teach that people, you know, people that one thing at a time. But it's very clear we're on the right side of history here. This is happening. This is a movement that's happening across the country. And the growth rate of the North Carolina Distillers Association is, quite frankly, a lot faster than craft brewing was. I mean, we've got 52 distillers in under 7 years. And, you know, it took at least 12 years to get to that point for craft brewers.
And let's put that into context, because as you say, North Carolina now has 52 distilleries. Kentucky, which is the home of bourbon in America, has 57. And we are scheduled to pass them this year. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
That's amazing.
But what's funny is that, and even with craft beer, there are people on the state side that see this not as an opportunity and potential. They see this as a pain in the rear. But there are folks on the state side that really see this as an opportunity. So folks at the Department of Agriculture, folks at the Tourism Department, you know, these folks really see this as a positive. So Robbie, Andrew, and I, we're giving tours 3, 4, 5, 6 times a week. And we're making friends for the industry and for our brands, one person at a time.
Let's get back to Ben's email because he had a couple of more questions, one of which is, are there any Charlotte ABC venues that carry more local labels than any in nearby South Carolina? Do you know?
All the ABC stores are required to have a Made in North Carolina section, which is a great thing that the ABC system has done for us. But it's up to the individual stores to
give it prominence.
Yeah, where they put it, how they put it, and they could put it in the back of the store facing the back wall. So sometimes people never see it. I read an interesting study once that I think it's the average time spent in ABC store is 45 seconds. Usually the person goes in there, they know exactly what they want.
That was my point.
They go and grab it and they leave. So they're not exactly looking around the shelves to see what's available.
I don't know about you guys, but whenever I go into an ABC store, I feel vaguely guilty about being there. Vaguely
by design.
Guilty. Like, exactly. Maybe I shouldn't be in here.
I don't know. You feel like you're in like a porno shop.
Exactly. That's exactly right.
So I don't know if it's that bad.
It's changing.
I think things are changing. And so, for example, Jason, who's the new CEO of Mecklenburg ABC, has approached it. And what we're going to see, so the writer or the listener that wrote in, what you're going to see in Mecklenburg specifically is more prominent placement of North Carolina distilleries, and we appreciate the support.
South Carolina has a different setup. So what is that like for you guys? I don't know whether I know that you export, Scott, to all kinds of places around the country, but what's it like elsewhere?
Well, South Carolina's distribution is private, so it's just run different. I consider it the Wild West, whereas we're in North Carolina more friendly towards the brewing industry. South Carolina is the opposite. It's easier to be a distiller and harder to be a brewer.
Are you on the shelves in South Carolina?
We are on the shelves. Product? We've only been on the shelves for since November.
Okay.
In South Carolina.
Where do you export? Because you do a lot of exporting, Scott.
Right. So we're in 14 states. And to give you an idea of the difference, another control state is Pennsylvania. And so the difference there, though, is that one of the misunderstandings of North Carolina system is that the state owns the ABC stores. North Carolina doesn't own the ABC stores. We grant franchises to local towns and municipalities and counties. And as a result, that's why we have to go through to each one and sell it. In Pennsylvania, on the other hand, the state owns all of the stores. And so when they accepted me in, I'm immediately in 100 stores in Pennsylvania. So a very, very different situation. In South Carolina, the challenges are different. And I personally think that the opportunity to get shelf space, it's nice because it's not a quasi-governmental function. However, I don't think the challenges are any less. They're just different than doing an operation in a control state.
Now, if the state makes the environment better for distillers, this means more tax revenue, it seems to me, right?
Absolutely.
It's keeping, and if you're using local products, that increases the local economy. Mm-hmm. And if you're allowed to export, as you do, Scott, to these other states, that's bringing money in as opposed to having money go from Charlotte or Wake County into Kentucky if you want to buy Maker's
Mark.
Very important. Do they understand that at the legislative level? Are you getting support at the legislative level? I only have 10 seconds, 15 seconds.
We do. We are getting a lot. We've got a lot of friends with that, and people are understanding that distilling has an opportunity to actually displace brewing as a primary economic engine of the fermentation distilling area, because, again, distilling makes world-class spirits using North Carolina products.
Let me stop you there. Scott Maitland, the president of the North Carolina Distillers Association, Rob Delaney with Muddy River Distillery, and Andrew Porter of Doc Porter's Distillery.